Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With their shaven heads, steel-toed combat boots, and bomber jackets, neo-Nazis were pretty easy to pick out of a crowd in the 1990s. They were the skinheads, angry, volatile, and responsible for violent crime waves across Europe especially, but also in America. Today's young hyper-nationalists in Germany, France, and Italy look more like hipsters, wearing skinny jeans, bushy beards, maybe even carrying a tote bag. In Germany, they're being called Nipsters, as in Nazi hipsters. There is now neo-Nazi programming on the internet, including a show on vegan cooking. There's neo-Nazi techno, DJ Adolf is the biggest act, neo-Nazi reggae, and even hip-hop. Freelance journalist Thomas Rogers is based in Berlin. He stepped inside of the anti-gay, anti-immigrant, radically racist of the Nipsters and reported on it for Rolling Stone magazine. The article is called Heil Hipster, the Young Neo-Nazis Trying to Put a Stylish Face on Hate. Thomas Rogers, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So first, help us understand the neo-Nazi party presence in Germany right now in terms of numbers, mainstream acceptance, platforms, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, the main sort of outlet for the extreme right in Germany, or the most mainstream outlet for it, is a party called the NPD, the Nationaldemokratische Partei Deutschland in German. And they have been around since shortly after the war, but they've never managed to actually really break through and make it into the German parliament because the support just hasn't been there. The government has also tried to ban them once before, and they're trying to ban them right now because Germany has very strict laws in terms of what people can and can't say related to the Second World War and to the Nazi Party. So in the last few years, the numbers in terms of members of the extreme right have stayed pretty steady at around 22,000 people. There are around 900 of them that are considered members of the extreme right with a potential for violence. But what has been noticeable in the last year, at least, is that the number of physical violent attacks against people with immigrant backgrounds have been on the increase in Germany. And there's sort of various hypotheses as to why that might be the case.
Well, okay, 22,000 out of an entire population of what in Germany?
I think it's about 60 million people.
Yeah, so it's very small, but still these waves of violence, is it anything like the hate crimes that we saw in the 1980s and 90s, for example?
No, in the years after, you're referring to the sort of crime wave that happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall, at which point the neo-Nazi movement spread into the East and sort of took advantage of the alienation a lot of young people felt back then once the sort of communist structures had disappeared and didn't really know what to do with themselves because sort of capitalism and the West had moved into an area where it hadn't been before. Then in the 1990s, there was also a campaign to educate people on how to identify Nazis, on stigma that stigmatized also the extreme right in Germany, and that helped kind of tamp down that movement by the turn of the century. And then, as I explained in the article, certain other developments have taken place since then.
Well, the campaign to identify is what this Nipster movement really speaks to, these neo-Nazi hipsters. You met some of the leaders of sorts within the movement. One, Patrick Schroeder, he hosts an internet television show. Tell us a little bit about him and the agenda of FSN TV.
Right. So Patrick Schroeder is a neo-Nazi who's centered in Bavaria, and his major claim to fame is that he hosts Germany's only neo-Nazi internet television show. And there are a lot of other figures within the neo-Nazi scene in Germany that are similar to him, but he is probably the one who's best at promoting himself. And he's also somewhat controversial in the scene because he talks to the media, whereas others kind of shy away from it. But he is very forceful in arguing that today's neo-Nazi scene in Germany needs to be more mainstream, that people need to dress in a way that makes them less scary to people, and they need to embrace international youth culture in a way that hasn't been sort of acceptable within the neo-Nazi movement in previous decades. And that includes hip-hop, that includes hipster style. He himself is a big fan of American television, including How I Met Your Mother. He has very strong feelings about the finale.
So he's in the media front. In the political front, there's a man named Andy Knapp, who's head of the young movement within the NDP. So it's his job to actually make extreme right politics appealing. Many in the movement don't go to rallies anymore. They use other online tactics. Like what?
Right. Andy Knapp is very interested in using the internet to recruit young people. And he thinks that things like the Harlem Shake, which was a meme that popped up about a year ago in which people filmed short videos of themselves dancing around to a certain electronic music song. And so they filmed their version of that and a bunch of people sort of dancing around junked cars, holding a sign saying, have more sex with Nazis, unprotected. And he thinks sort of using popular culture to reach young people are the way that the movement can keep itself alive in the coming years.
Let's just hear a little bit from that video. That is a video that's, I don't know, has it gone viral? How many people have taken a look at this?
Well, before the article came out, I'd say it was about 17,000 people that had watched it, which is, you know, it's a lot of people mm-hmm. for Germany and certainly for German neo-Nazis. I think since the article has come out, it's been about 60,000 or 70,000 now. I haven't really been checking the last few days.
So does Andy Knapp see any kind of irony to using, you know, sort of hip-hop, reggae, other African-influenced or African diaspora-influenced music in his videos?
Well, I think the argument that he makes and the arguments that others would make as well is that this is the culture that everybody grows up with now and that the scene shouldn't dwell too much on where the music comes from and should just manage to such as use it for its own purposes without sort of thinking too hard about the fact that, you know, hip hop is a form of music that came out of New York City, very specific to the African-American community. I think there's resistance within the scene to this idea of neo-Nazi hip-hop, and it certainly hasn't been uncontroversial, but I think among the younger members, you know, it makes complete sense because German culture, like culture everywhere else, is becoming much more international, and young Germans, they listen to hip-hop just as much as American teenagers do, and often can't really distinguish between what's German popular culture and what's American popular culture.
Hmm. You also cite in your article young neo-Nazis dressed up as the Cookie Monster, distributing leaflets to children. A proliferation of Tumblrs using the hashtag Nipster on Instagram. I wonder, would Andy Knapp, for example, identify himself as a Nipster, as a neo-Nazi hipster?
I think he would probably be somewhat reticent to do that. I think he might do it ironically. The same way that I think if you call anybody a hipster, they are not going to want to say that they're a hipster, even if they are, you know, they fit all the criteria. But I think he sees the Nipster as a tool. And he, you know, if you meet him, he's this very charming 20-year-old guy. He looks, you know, he dresses just like any kind of young person would. He looks like he's a college student in the U.S. And I think by the criteria that a lot of people in the movement would apply to a Nipster, he would certainly qualify. But, you know, I think Shuda would be more likely to proudly call himself a Nipster. You know, it is a term that was invented from the outside and was sort of partly meant to make fun of them. And now they've taken it upon themselves. And you know, his press assistant has said very proudly that they've taken over the Nipster.
We're getting a glimpse into the world of the neo-Nazi hipster or Nipsters with the journalist Thomas Rogers. He reported on this growing movement to make extreme right-wing politics hip, non-threatening among German youth especially. It's not the neo-Nazi rallies or combat boots that they're selling, but carefully curated Instagram feeds, music videos, and other social media. You mentioned a change in the sort of neo-Nazi movement around the turn of the century. Why? What began to change?
Right. Well, I mentioned the sort of educational campaign that occurred in the 90s, sort of teaching people to identify members of the neo-Nazi scene and also stigmatizing them. And so around the turn of the century, a group appeared that called themselves the Nationalautonomen. And they are—they sort of aped the look of the left, of the far left in Germany, sort of people like the Black Bloc, so anarchist activists, who tend to dress in all black and hoodies. And it was a way of avoiding that stigma. And it was also a way of sort of kind of the skinhead thing had sort of died out in a way because of that education that had happened in the 90s. And then that in turn prompted a sort of broader liberalization of the fashion within the scene, certainly not of the politics, but it made it more acceptable for people to wear different things and still identify as a neo-Nazi, and also sort of gradually incorporate different political subjects into neo-Nazi ideology that weren't traditionally seen as sort of extreme right issues like environmentalism and animal protection.
So, Thomas, you can just purchase a look or wear a different set of clothes that will help you pass, as they say. Is this just a strategy to normalize right-wing identity? If you don't know that you're speaking to a neo-Nazi and have a conversation, what can happen?
Well, to some extent, it's a conscious change that's taken place. But to some extent, to a large extent, it's also simply a reflection of the way youth culture has changed. Before, if you wanted to become part of the scene, you had to really, change the way you look, shave your head to a large extent, not always, but often. That's hard to sell that to young people, is that you really have to completely dedicate your life and your appearance to your political ideology. And it makes it much more palatable in terms of attracting young people if you can tell them, you can still wear the pants that you always wear, you can still wear the shirts that you always wear, as long as you have the right kind of ideology in your brain.
I want to pick up on that point, because you spoke to a researcher about this kind of identity shifting, who connected it with the anonymity and the kind of shape shifting that is allowed online. Expand on that, if you would.
Right. One of the things that a number of people have spoken about, that the internet has changed about the way young people and people in general exist, is that we are on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we express our ideas, our thoughts in different places, and sometimes those aren't entirely coherent. Sometimes we take on different personas. And so what young people can do in Germany is that they can try out different ideas, different ideologies, and often those aren't very coherent. You can argue for one thing with your friends at school, and you can argue for a very different thing in a sort of online forum somewhere else. And so that creates a sort of sense of incoherence that in a way plays into this transformation, that you can sort of argue against immigrants, say very racist things in one area, and then at the same time be a huge fan of Rihanna on the other end. So, that in a way is sort of part of the schizophrenia of the internet age, and that plays into this kind of this change that's been happening within the scene.
So people can try on this identity without committing to shaving their heads or risk losing their jobs, for example, if they're perceived as extremists or a threat. But what is the threat here with this stealthy kind of kinder, gentler look for neo-Nazi parties there in Germany?
Well, the threat in terms of sort of opponents of the extreme right is that they're much harder to identify as young people. So before, it was much easier for a teacher, for example, to identify which kids in his or her class might have extreme right sympathies simply because they had a shaved head or it was sort of visually very clear. And now, they might be wearing a piece of clothing from Tor Steiner, which is a sort of brand that is very popular in the neo-Nazi scene, but is not doesn't obviously affiliate itself with the neo-Nazi scene, under a jacket or under a hoodie, and you might never know, what their affiliations might be. This also means that it's harder for, for the police to identify people, and ultimately the goal is to prevent violence, to prevent right-wing extremism, and as I mentioned, sort of that there's been a dramatic rise in terms of violence against people with immigrant backgrounds in Germany over the past year, and it's, the goal is to eliminate that as much as possible, I think.
Well, Thomas Rogers, scary, fascinating. Thank you very much for your reporting on this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thomas Rogers is a freelance journalist. He's based in Berlin, and he reported for Rolling Stone on the young neo-Nazis who are trying to put a stylish face on hate. And the article is called Heil Hipster. You'll find a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 40th annual Market Days Festival kicks off in downtown Concord this weekend. Vendors and local businesses will hit the sidewalks to peddle their wares and meet their customers. Among those, a curious shop that opened its doors just about a year ago. Word-of-mouth intern Molly Donahue stopped by the store and brings us this story.
Squeezed into downtown Concord at number 32.5 North Main Street, there's a store that seems like it would fit better in the 1940s or 50s. A more innocent time, perhaps. A time before the handheld technology that allows us to be constantly texting, searching the web, and playing games. But it's not the games that they object to at Yo-Yo Heaven. In fact, they probably play more games at work than your average Candy Crush addict. The store name is self-explanatory. Yo-Yo Heaven is a skill toy store with a focus on its namesake. It's owned by the father and son team Andy and Dan McBride. Andy handles the business, while Dan is the one with a passion for yo-yos.
Well, there are standard tricks that you do, like you go to double nothing, one and a half mouse, switch it to a Kweegee bow, do a couple Eli hops. I
mean, they opened the store in 2013 with a modest goal, to meet other yo-yoers and allow those interested in high-end yo-yos to come in and test them out. But they soon realized that more people were interested in yo-yos than even they had imagined. And now, business is booming.
We've discovered that there's basically three types of yo-yoers around. There are the professionals. There are the younger yo-yoers from, say, 7 to, let's say, 16, that are just getting into yo-yo, want to come down and play with something. They've heard about them. So I would say that's probably the largest group. And then the third group would be the nostalgia people.
And Yo-Yo Heaven has something for all of them.
The least expensive yo-yo we have in the store is about $5. The most expensive right now is about $200.
Yes, you heard that right. $200.
We have all of the high-end yo-yos up in the window. So people coming along can look at them and wonder, why does that yo-yo cost $200? And we get that question every day, at least five times a day.
To someone unfamiliar with yo-yos, that may seem like a pretty steep price. But not all yo-yos are created equal.
Yo-yos are designed for different sorts of play. There are five classes of yo-yo when you go into competition. Each of those classes somewhat requires its own style of yo-yo. So what makes a most expensive one are there are very unique companies that make highly specialized yo-yos that are precisionally tuned. They have special bearings, they have special response systems, and they have special strings.
And if you're wondering what sorts of competitions are being held for yo-yo enthusiasts, you're not alone.
Well, in competition, there are five different classes, like he said. There's 1A, which is string trick yo-yo, so that's one non-responsive yo-yo in your throw hand. And then there's 2A, which is one in each hand, but they're responsive yo-yos. That's a type of yo-yoing called looping, out in front of you style tricks.
It turns out, those yo-yos you may remember playing with as a kid don't make an appearance in competitions. They're simply responsive yo-yos. Ones that come back when you tug on them.
Everybody remembers the Dunkin' yo-yo, right? They started out in 1921.
By golly, it's a yo-yo! Gadzooks! A genuine Dunkin' Jr. yo-yo!
You heard him, kids.
They've been around the longest producing yo-yos. But those yo-yos, when they first started out, were a solid fixed axle, no bearing, typically a wooden axle. And most people remember like the Imperial or the butterfly style yo-yo. But that's the one everybody starts out with to walk the dog, rock the baby, just basic down and up.
And they aren't much good in complicated routines. They are very big amongst kids and nostalgia seekers, though. And many people come in looking for them. Like other specialty stores, skill toy stores have to rely on some walk-in business, not just people who already know what they're looking for. So, for walk-in clients, they still have other skill toys like juggling accessories, kendamas, marbles, and boomerangs. But yo-yos are their bread and butter. Andy and Dan carry full lines of yo-yos from brands like Dunkin' and Yomega, which means Yo-Yo Heaven is one of the few stores in New Hampshire that can meet almost any yo-yo-related request you might have.
Somebody will call and say, I'm looking for the Dunkin' Freak Hand. It needs to be blue with this dice. Do you have it? And the typical answer is yes, we do.
As far as I can tell, the whole store and business model seems like a practice in, if you build it, they will come.
Have you found that there is a big yo-yo community here in Concord?
It is amazingly large, yeah. So when we first opened the store, we were greatly surprised at the success of it. When we first opened it, we thought that it wouldn't be that large of a following at the beginning.
It turns out there's a large yo-yo community in Greater New Hampshire, too. The New Hampshire Yo-Yo Club meets the first Saturday of every month in Manchester, and competitors met in June at the New Hampshire State Yo-Yo Competition to determine who would move on to regionals in Massachusetts. For now, Andy and Dan have been pleasantly surprised by how responsive people have been, unlike those high-end competition yo-yos. For Word of Mouth, I'm Molly Donahue.
Yo-Yo Heaven will be among the stores participating in Market Days the 17th to the 19th of July. Daniel Dietz, a nationally ranked yo-yoer, will be demonstrating at the store all 3 days. Andy and Dan will also be there to answer questions. Who knows? Maybe they'll even let you test out one of those $200 yo-yos. Up next, bringing up bookworms in the digital age. We're going to learn about the practice of interactive reading and share some tips on how to encourage kids to turn their eyes away from the screen and onto the page. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jason Bogue loves books. As a toddler, he was a frequent visitor at the local library in Lyons, Michigan. He continued reading and writing his way to a journalism degree at NYU, spent 5 years as the publishing editor for Media Bistro, where he covered books and publishing. Then he became a dad. Jason and his wife wanted their daughter, Olive, to love books, but knew she'd be born into a world full of screens and digital devices. So Jason wrote a book. He talked to doctors and authorities on child development, education, and literature to get the latest advice on encouraging today's kids to read. The result is Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age.
It's really simple. Parents can learn it in about an hour. It's basically when you're reading a book to a child, you really have to make it an interactive experience for them. You need to ask questions about the colors, about the feelings that the characters are having. And if you have a child that's not even ready to talk about these things, you can point and you can help them interact with the text itself. That interaction is one of the most important things you can do for a growing child's brain.
Well, there are 15 points to this interactive reading, and we can't go through all of them individually, so we'll just kind of use that as a lens for this entire conversation. First, when do you start reading to a kid?
I tell people that those first couple weeks, just do it. I mean, reading is a set of motions. We all think that we were kind of readers, that it's in our blood or something like that, but it's not. It's a set of motions that you were taught by your parents or the caregivers, the people that cared to share books with you. Earlier this, about a month ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics actually put out recommendations telling pediatricians to start informing parents of this very fact, that you should just be reading from infancy onward with your child.
And you write that kids can interact with books at 6 months. Interact? Really? How?
This is actually the very first piece of evidence I collected myself for the book. I had been reading to my daughter this book called Lost and Found, and I had been reading that book to my daughter for a few months, and she just sits there. I don't know how many people in the audience have experience with newborns. They just sit there. They don't do anything. They're very mute. But I could see her eyes following it, and about 6 months in, I had been reading this book for a while, and the penguin, there's this triumphant moment when he comes back, and every time I would be interactive, I would highlight that moment with expressive motions, and it was magical. She lit up, and she actually squealed for joy. It was the first reaction I had ever seen her have to a piece of text, and it was for me the very first moment that she grasped how a story worked.
You speak to others who have done other research. John Protzko at NYU wrote about how to make kids smarter. Some data from Dr. Grover Whitehurst, who came up with this idea of interactive reading after studying 21 to 35-month-olds. You write about giving kids a leg up by teaching them to read. Any factual data or numbers you can share with us that illustrate that point?
Yeah, the NYU study you mentioned by Proxco, that was the one that really turned me on to this. They looked at about 6 to 8 different studies of child development and found that reading to a child can quantitatively raise their IQ by 6 points. Seeing that number really kind of blew my mind. I mean, in some ways, it is common sense. I mean, we know that reading is helpful and that people that have been reading books, it makes them smarter. But the cognitive gains that happen that early in a child's life, I think it's really important. You can't reiterate it enough that reading really is important. Changing your child's brain, making them smarter, and also just making them more emotionally healthy as they're learning how to explain their feelings and how to actually control those feelings.
Now, you encourage parents to carefully consider how and when they introduce digital devices to kids. We've heard the argument that devices are more interactive than paper books and therefore healthier than watching television, for example. How do digital books and devices fit into this idea of interactive reading?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that word interactive lately. If you look at any app store right now, you'll see that word interactive batted around many, many times. And there's two senses of the word interactive. There's one, the sense of a device that can interact with its user. The other, more profound meaning for me, is an interaction between two people, and that's what interactive reading means. It's when a human being is talking to another human being. And it turns out, I spoke to neuroscientists about that, it turns out that for a growing brain, the only thing that will help that brain grow, that will carve new neural pathways in the brain, is the human voice. You could have one of these devices reading a book to you, but it would not have the same impact that you see when a human is reading that same book to them.
How do you encourage your kids to read books in an age dominated by screens? Jason Bogue is with us. We've spoken to him many times when he led the Galley Cat blog. Now he's out with a new practical guide to encouraging kids to develop a lifelong love of reading. It's called Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age. Do we have enough data now on when to introduce digital devices to kids? And what did you come away with? Any suggestions?
Yeah, I still, the child development community does not have enough data to conclusively say this is the correct amount of time to spend. I go back to the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations that were issued a few years ago. I still believe them. I still think they're important. It says no or minimalize screen time before 2 years old. And after that, I wouldn't do more than an hour a day. It's tough. It's not going to make your life easier. These devices are tremendous. Powerful babysitters. And I encourage parents to try to do the same thing and just to really be mindful how much time you're spending on these devices. And the other really, really important thing that numerous experts told me is no devices at bedtime. Let your child know that bedtime is when we read books or when we tell each other stories, but those screens are tremendously disruptive to sleep patterns and just your calming down process.
Well, I imagine that one of the well-thumbed pages in the book will be page 64, How to Avoid Using Devices. Some tactics. But one of the things I enjoyed about the book is that you do know that kids are going to be drawn to apps. They're going to be drawn to electronic books, to television, to other media. So one of the tactics you use is a kind of reading bundle. I'd like to unpack one of those reading bundles now. Here's something to lead us into that may sound very familiar to listeners.
Lemon, don't let them see. Be a good girl. You always have to be. Let it go. Let it go.
That's a 4-year-old from Brooklyn singing Let It Go, the song from Frozen that is just on just about any kid's lips. So let's explore this idea. Just about every kid in America knows the words to that song. What are some suggestions for launching off of that passion into books?
Yeah, well, Virginia, I first of all, I'm kind of hurt. You should have just asked me to sing that song. I'm perfectly capable of singing it. You don't need to bring on 4-year-olds.
You might not be as instantly cute.
No, we sing that song all the time in my house, and it was one of those things. I mean, it comes into your house as an audiovisual thing. It's a movie, and you want to limit that time that she spends watching movies, and But she had such enthusiasm for it. And over and over and over, the experts told me the only way children learn is when they're chasing the things that they're interested in. So I looked at this. I said, here's something she's really interested in. What can we do to expand upon that? So I went to the bookstore, and Random House has published tons of Frozen spin-off books. The one that I recommend, after looking at many, many of them, the Frozen Big Golden Book is really the most satisfying out of all of those. It's a way of revisiting a movie and kind of having an interactive reading experience going through the story again on the page. And then after that, you can use, and I started to do this with Olive, there's a number of apps that actually let your child tell a story. My Story, Feltboard, Draw and Tell, Toontastic, these are all really powerful tools for letting your child tell stories with simple digital puppets, simple digital tools that they can draw with. And you can say, hey, I know you love the story of Elsa and Anna. What happens next? And they can actually draw it. Or if they can't draw, they can use these little puppets and make voices and record themselves making the sequel to Frozen and continuing that story. It's really cool to watch them learn storytelling that way. And then the thing I've been reminding parents is it's based on Hans Christian Andersen's The Snow Queen, which is a really great fairy tale that I hadn't read in many, many, many years. There's a lot of amazing stuff going on in that story. I found an old-time radio drama adaptation of it, like a 1930s kids show that adapted it. It was really fun. Olive and I spent time listening to that in the car. And then The Great Chukowski did an adaptation as well, and I found that adaptation with a Russian ballerina reading the story, and Olive was enraptured by the whole thing. And Olive and I sat in the car and spent many hours discussing how love can thaw the frozen heart, which is the message of both Hans Christian Andersen's story and Frozen as well.
That makes it so exciting, and I guess feel a little bit less like, I don't know, brain candy to watch a Disney film. But I do read a lot of dispiriting statistics on kids raised in households that don't read or are very verbal. Is this interactive reading model something that public education, not just parents, can take up?
I really feel it's a public health issue, exactly what you've just described. I feel like we should be treating those statistics as something as troubling as malnutrition. I mean, it's really an important part of brain growth for children. And just because these techniques take about an hour to learn, and they were tested in communities where there weren't a lot of resources, and it's easy for anyone to learn it. So I was really encouraged that the American Academy of Pediatrics is now telling doctors to remind parents that this is important. But I really think it should be a policy push. We really should just be making sure that parents have this information when they leave the hospital.
Okay, so with the pack of disposable diapers, Born Reading by Jason Bogue in every Bring It On Home kit, huh?
Well, it doesn't have to be my book. I would think there's plenty, and I stress this on my website as well. Like, if someone it doesn't have the resources to reach out for my book, there are plenty of free resources to learn the art of interactive reading online too. Plenty of things you can print off, put on your refrigerator. I feel this is so important, and whatever we can do to spread the message to parents is valuable.
Well, Jason, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for being with us again.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I love being on the show. Thank you.
Jason Bogue, Director of Story Investigation at True Pictures. His new book is called Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age, from picture books to ebooks and everything in between. It features suggestions for the best books and teacher-approved apps for kids from birth to age 5, and there's much more practical advice on his website. You'll find a link to it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to leave you with a little bit of one of Tchaikovsky's compositions from The Snow Queen. Anna is one of the princesses from Frozen, and she's sassy and she's magical and, of course, has a heart of gold. Up next, we scour the history books for stories of real princesses who fought and stole and schemed. Princesses behaving badly. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. As long as there have been stories of princesses, there have been little girls to love them. The Disney princess phenomenon seeds young imaginations with shiny pink costumes. Gossip magazines continue the fantasy with pages devoted to Kate Middleton and before her, princesses Grace and Diana, the latter proving that becoming royalty is no guarantee of living happily ever after. Beyond these two-dimensional characters are scores of real princesses, sometimes tragic, often extraordinary human beings who left scant record of their lives. Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie scoured through history for stories of women who fought and stole and schemed and survived and pulls them together in her new book, Princesses Behaving Badly, Real Stories from History Without the Fairy Tale Endings. And Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie joins us now from the BBC in London. Welcome to you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You introduce us in your book to what you call the princess industrial complex and the princess obsession default setting for many little girls. What worries you about that?
Well, I think I'm certainly not alone in being worried about it, but I think largely what concerns me is that that also seems to imply both an unjustified sense of entitlement and also not particularly accurate representations of reality, accurate expectations of what girls can and should achieve. And really, it just sort of promotes this fantasy that the most exciting thing about being a girl or being a grown-up girl is, you know, pretty dresses and ball gowns and sparkly things and makeup and Prince Charmings. And when you look at characters like Merida, the most recent princess from Disney Pixar's Brave, she's a great character. I loved her. I thought it was a fun movie. And I thought that she was really sort of, you know, she's harnessing her own destiny, all those sorts of things. But that's really only half the story that girls get. The other half of the story is all the merchandising that goes along with it. And I think that is almost more powerful than the original material. And, you know, so for example, in the case of Merida, one of the most popular items that was for sale, one of the most popular merchandise items was this doll that came in this sparkly blue dress, the dress that she hated in the movie, and was accessorized by a hair comb. That's not really the point of this character, but that's kind of the message that the little girls get. They take away this message of, you know, dress up heels and sparkly and pink and... And that's a little limiting to me and a little worrying in how much emphasis it places on physical appearance and possessions.
So let's dig into some of those stories. You have warriors like Alfhild, who became a pirate, and Ping Yang, who commanded an army of 70,000, and one that I especially liked, Olga of Kiev, who slaughtered many people, the Derivilian tribe, who had murdered her husband. They offered her another husband. They sent an envoy of people. She buried them alive. They sent another envoy of people. She killed them. Tell me about this woman's trajectory to what she became, a saint.
It's absolutely fascinating. She basically slaughters her way through this entire tribe before she eventually makes war on their lands and forces the people behind the wall of their main city for a siege that lasted about a year. During that siege, she told them towards the end of it, she said, well, you know what, we should call this off, you know, and if you guys should give me some birds from your houses, I will go in peace, I swear. So they're like, okay, we believe you this time. So each family presented her with a gift of these birds. And that night she had her men tie pieces of lit sulfur, basically lit matches, to all the feet of the birds, which then flew home to roost in the homes of the people who just gave them to her, setting the entire city on fire. And that's how she won. She eventually converted to Christianity, which kind of wipes the slate clean. And the whole murdering lots and lots of people thing, just, you know, it didn't happen. It was part of her pagan past before she became a Christian.
Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie is with us to talk about bad, bad princesses. Her new book is called Princesses Behaving Badly, Real Stories from History Without the Fairy Tale Endings. Many of the stories of these women here defy the idea that women through history did, you know, needlepoint and dressed in gowns while their husbands ruled. Tell us about some of the female rulers that you became aware of in your research.
There were certainly quite a few of them. And I think it's also important to note that, you know, simply just because they were a female ruler doesn't mean that they were a very good ruler. Mm-hmm. There were a number of women that I came across who, you know, were just as flawed as the men were. Mm. Other women, however, were very good at what they did and to some degree were punished for being just as ruthless or as ambitious as the men around them. Wu Zaishan was an emperor of China. She had ruled for years and years and years through her husband, who had been emperor of the 7th century dynasty, the Song dynasty, until she eventually just declared for herself after he died that she was the emperor, and that was it. She was a very effective ruler in a lot of ways. You know, under her, I think taxes went down and, you know, deserving officials were given pay rises. War kind of stopped. At the same time, because she was a female ruler and because that was so shocking and so monstrous to a number of the people in power and around her, she's been historically maligned and treated as this sort of demon. Now, how much of the stories are true, it's difficult to say, but there is certainly an element of slandering her because she didn't fit the mold. She didn't fit what women were supposed to do then.
Well, lest we think that your book is all about old world princesses, we do have the Native American Sarah Winnemucca of the Northern Paiute tribe, and Clara Ward, a woman who in the 20th century married into royalty. Which one of those stories would you like to pick up?
Oh, I'd love to talk about Clara Ward. She's one of my favorites. She was married off to this Belgian prince in the 1890s, and in 1896 ran off with a Hungarian gypsy violinist. So she left her marriage, ran off with a gypsy violinist that she met in Paris. Very romantic. She was divorced from her husband by January of next year, and by February of the following year, of 1897, all the newspapers were reporting that her relationship with the gypsy Hungarian violinist was stormy, tempestuous, involved lots of fighting in hotels and things like that. She eventually left him and married someone else who may have been a railway station manager or a waiter. No one's really sure about that. And they divorced after he claimed that she was having an affair with the butler, whereupon she may have married the butler, although it's not clear whether he was a butler or someone else, a chauffeur, who knows. But I think the thing that I really loved about Clara Ward was that she really followed her own star. She did what she wanted to do. And there was certainly some collateral damage. I don't think she ever saw her children from her first marriage again. And she was, you know, widely slandered and considered one of the most scandalous women of the time in newspaper accounts across both continents. But she had a good time. Certainly can't deny that she had a good time.
So what you're doing is telling stories not just of not of princesses behaving badly necessarily, but strategically. And in trying to tell those real stories, we do have sex and incest and infidelity and murder and plotting and scheming. If you are trying to recast the princess, are these appropriate stories for tween girls? You know, how should we tell these stories?
They're definitely not appropriate for tween girls in a number of ways. But I think it's a valuable lesson to remember that it's not only tween girls who are kind of infected by this princess industrial complex idea. You know, it's the parents who end up buying the sparkly dresses for their daughters. But also, we are fascinated as adults with this idea of the princess fantasy. And equally, then there's our fascination with Kate Middleton, who, you know, by and large is being turned into a kind of cardboard cutout of a modern princess. And I have no idea how she feels about it, but it's slightly worrying to see so much attention paid to her wardrobe, so much attention paid to her post-baby body, and so much attention paid to sort of her behavior as it ranks among princesses, and not about the other things that she does, other things like charity work and the things that she says and things like that. So the book isn't aimed at tweens for sure, but it is aimed at every one of us who still kind of believes in the princess fantasy.
Linda Rodriguez McRobbie writes for the Smithsonian Magazine, Mental Floss, and other publications. Her new book is Princesses Behaving Badly, Real Stories from History Without the Fairy Tale Endings. Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And you can find much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we spoke to the author and book lover Jason Bogue and got his advice on bringing up bookworms in the digital age, the topic of his new book. We'd love to hear from you. Do you have any tips for encouraging children to read? Maybe there was a book that your child adored, or you figured out a clever way of getting them off of the computer screen and into the wonderful world of books. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. After all, the best advice travels by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for our Word of Mouth weekend show, which is now on Sunday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.